history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, and you never know what kind of amazing secrets they might be carrying. We're going to hear today about a secret that a Navy pilot had to keep to himself for over a half century, for reasons that I hope will become pretty clear. The idea behind this program is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only do we learn things that we couldn't really learn anywhere else, we are taken on a pretty entertaining ride. And many times, we feel inspired when we get a sense for just how much these brave Americans love our country. If you caught the show last time, you heard two regulars in a pretty special group known as the Old Bold Pilots. If you missed Rod Braswell and the Flying Greek, Steve Pisanos, last time, you can find that interview and about 400 more at hometownheroesradio.com. The Old Bold Pilots meet every Wednesday morning in Oceanside, California. If you ever find yourself in the San Diego area on a Wednesday and you want to shake some of their hands, it's the Denny's Restaurant on the corner of Vista Way and El Camino Real in Oceanside. And you'll know you're in the right place when you see the models of B-17s and P-51s and all kinds of warbirds hanging from the ceiling. Today you'll be hearing some applause, some announcements, and plenty of Denny's dishes in the background, but that'll just remind you that we recorded this while an Old Bold Pilots meeting was underway. The gentleman that we're going to meet today is remarkably humble for somebody who managed to pull off the kind of mission they make movies about, and it certainly was not like anything he ever expected.
90-year-old Royce Williams, originally from South Dakota, a pilot during World War II, and quite some exploits in the Korean War. In fact, if you pick up the January edition of Homeland Magazine, you'll see his smiling face on the cover, the forgotten hero of the forgotten war. And how's this for an introduction? In an exhausting 35-minute dogfight against seven Soviet MiGs, Lieutenant Williams became the only American aviator to single-handedly shoot down four Russian MiGs in a single sortie, a record that most likely will never be broken. Let's go way back before that, before you ever thought about flying or being in the Navy. Your childhood in South Dakota, what was that like growing up during the Great Depression?
Freedom. Your parents didn't worry about where I was, and I had friends, and we would go out from the small town and dam up a little creek and make a swimming pool, or a swimming hole. We played cowboys and Indians, and a lot of excitement and good pals.
Do you remember, even at that young of an age, having any ambitions or thoughts about what you might do in the future?
Oh, yes. Anytime an airplane came by, we were all heads up. Sometimes it would land on a field a mile or so out of town, and we would run all the way to be there. My brother, likewise, who's a retired Marine colonel, naval aviator, but when I was about eight, in our discussions, he wanted to be a naval aviator, I wanted to be a naval aviator, so our goal was set.
Why the Navy for flying as opposed to the old Army Air Corps?
I don't know. It must have been a movie or something.
Got you hooked. And your brother was older or younger?
Year and a half older.
So did he get in first?
Yes, 6 months ahead of me.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? Because everybody I've talked to who was alive back then seems to remember something.
I remember exactly. I was roller skating out in front of a store. My dad used his World War I bonus to buy a storefront, and he, being a carpenter and everything else he could do, built a residence behind it. And I was out there, and he said, Royce and Lynn, come on in. And it was the president on announcing Pearl Harbor. And I sat down in front of the radio and listened word by word.
Did that rock your world a little bit?
Oh, yes. Yes, because shortly after that, we signed up.
You both signed up at the same time, you and your brother?
No, I think I signed up first with the Minnesota Guard, and he went on to become a machinist at an outlet of the University of Minnesota at Morris, Minnesota. And then after a short period of that, he signed on.
So you wanted to get over there and do something about what was going on in the world, huh?
I thought I owed it. My dad believed in it. He was a machine gunner in World War I.
Wow. So the family legacy was there. Yes. And as far, I know we want to get to Korea and your incredible story from 1952, but as far as what you did for the rest of World War II, training to become a naval aviator, what are some of the things that stand out for you?
Well, I kind of knew open cockpit biplanes. I went around with the Barnstormer in high school. Used to go to county fairs and sell tickets and put on aerobatic exhibitions.
While you were in high school?
Yeah.
You were doing the aerobatics?
No, I was just going along for the ride.
Oh, okay.
Sell tickets, wipe the airplane down, and fly whenever I could.
That's a good job.
Yeah, it was. And so my early training was in an open cockpit, Navy-built N3N out of a pasture in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, a lot of academics and athletics in the cadet training program, and the next level was again in open cockpit steerman mm-hmm. out of Memphis, and then gradually into single wing, low, and eventually even retractable landing gear. So I finally got through. As the war was ending, I got extended and extended because they could see that the pipeline of pilots coming in was meeting the need plus.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew the SBD Dauntless as a aviation cadet, and then I went into fighters, Hellcats and Corsairs and Bearcats and on and on.
Mm-hmm. And what about your brother during World War II?
Yes, pretty much the same thing. He did his training out of Yankton, South Dakota initially, and then Minneapolis, Iowa pre-flight. And he chose the Marine route on commissioning, and he was deployed on the Bedoying Strait and in the Battle of Okinawa.
Ah, so he got in at the tail end.
Yes.
But he made it home from the war.
He did, and he stayed on, and in his last assignment as a colonel on Admiral McCain's staff in Hawaii, I relieved him, and he retired the next day and went into the swimming pool business.
Smart man. As for you, when World War II came to an end and you hadn't made it overseas, was there any kind of disappointment on your part that you didn't personally get over there?
Well, there was, but I realized I made the effort, and the rest was Navy program. I fulfilled it.
And I'm sure you didn't want another war. I mean, here there was a war to end all wars, and it's finally over, and America and its allies have won. But just a few years later, Korea crops up. What do you remember about getting deployed during that time period?
Well, I made several deployments right after the war. I was over there on the Princeton and got into Nagasaki shortly after the bomb hit there. I came back and I made regular Navy, so they sent me to the University of Minnesota since I was just a high school grad, and they wanted all their officers to have at least 2 years of college. So they sent me for a year and a half, and I got a four-year degree. Then they sent me on to Monterey School.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the war was on, and I wondered, why not me? Well, my time came up, and I went. Yes, I was more or less anxious to get in on it. And due course, Navy assignments, I finally got there.
And I'm sorry for bouncing around here, but you mentioned Nagasaki right after the bomb hit.
Yes.
There aren't too many people around today who saw what you saw there, experienced that. What did you see, and what did it do to you?
Well, I knew just about everything I needed to know about it. Seeing kind of magnified it. It was a vast, level area where a lot of manufacturing had been, and the really only thing rising much above ground level were smokestacks that were circular reinforced steel cement as we're standing. But at the north end of the city, there was a rise of hills, and their commercial part of town and a lot of residents were on the other side of this hill, and the pressure from the bomb just went up and over them, and it was maintained, probably got some gamma rays or something, but was not in any way molested.
Mm-hmm. Was it just as a human being to see that there was something capable of that? Was that something that kind of changed your perspective a little?
I think I grew up with it about as early as anybody knew about it. When I was stationed on exchange duty with the Air Force over at Nellis, and they were doing a lot of testing during the time.
Mm.
And I'd be notified that it would be 4 o'clock in the morning, the family would get up and watch the sky light up. I went through Aniwetok at about the time they were doing the testing there and saw all of the ships assemble. And I became a weapons delivery officer later on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the nuclear age.
I guess so. And this caption I read earlier, the forgotten hero of the forgotten war, the Korean War, is often forgotten, often overlooked. And you did something in that war that I'm sure you never planned on, that you probably didn't see coming. But November 18th, 1952, what can you tell us about what happened that day?
Well, the Navy carrier force was fully involved in basically operating at the 38th parallel, the division of North and South Korea, and our mission was air to ground, of protecting our troops and destroying enemy trains and trucks and supply lines, tunnels and so forth. And we were not engaged with the MiGs. That was a separate war going on with the Air Force to see who could get the big headlines. But they decided that some of the factories that we should be destroying were beyond our range from there, so they moved a task force of 3 carriers and probably 20-some other ships closer to the Yalu, the river that divides Soviet Union and North Korea. And I was on the first raid pre-dawn and hitting at dawn on a city called Horyong. Our targets were manufacturing sites and warehouses.
And what were you flying?
I was flying a Panther, an F-9F5.
And a lot of people aren't familiar with that plane. They know the ones before it and after it. But what was unique about that plane? What did you appreciate about it?
Well, it was a jet. And we had a jet squadron early, the FJ-1s, VF-51, which was a forerunner of the F-86.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work out especially well to where the Navy decided to go wholly into the jets. But then as time moved on, we did, and the Panther was one of the very first of a line of jet aircraft. I was originally assigned to a Corsair squadron, being qualified in it. But when I saw the Panthers over there, I learned the name of the commanding officer. Was a guy I knew back at the University of Minnesota. So I sought his help, and he got me transferred to his squadron.
So your airspeed and your horsepower increased a little bit, going from the prop to the jet. And getting back to November of 1952, so you're flying this F-9F. That's a jet aircraft. But the Soviets, of course, have the MiG fighters in the air as well. And pick it up where you left off before I interrupted you.
Well, I came back, and they always maintain a combat air patrol over the task force. Well, I had had a cold, and I had fewer flights recently, so I was tabbed to take the next one. I went as a part of a 4-plane Panther flight, and the weather was lousy, 400 feet base of the clouds, terrible winds and driving snow. We launched, catapult launch off the Oriskany, our carrier, and formed up below the clouds, climbed through them, and on top we saw the incoming contrails of a warning, heads up, that we'd gotten from our combat information center that there were bogies, unidentified aircraft, inbound. And so when we popped through the clouds, we saw them. I saw them anyway.
And within minutes, he would be outnumbered and overmatched. But clearly, he lived to tell the story, a story that had to be kept under wraps for more than 50 years. We'll explain when we come back. For photos and a link to that magazine article you heard me mention, head on over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting RVCountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This February,
when the Messiah comes, Rome will be nothing.
Prepare to witness the miracle that changed the world forever.
The Nazarene city rise again after 3 days. We will lose peace and order if it's true.
Through the eyes of a non-believer. Risen, starring Joseph Fiennes.
The tomb is sealed, guarded with your life.
The most important manhunt in history.
The body has vanished.
His tomb is empty.
Was just beginning.
No more lies. What happened to the body?
The ropes, they just exploded.
Risen.
Where does he go?
You tell me.
You're looking for something you'll never find.
Open your heart and see.
Risen. Rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13. Now playing. For tickets and showtimes, go to risen-movie.com.
With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV Country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly-and-buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV.
It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV Country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.